So this is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT, and I think we have Robin Philpott himself on the line. Are you there, Robin?
Hi, Phil.
Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
Well, let's start with this business of protest and encampments. You have one in McGill. It's a kind of a similar to the University of Toronto in terms of university going to the courts, and there was a victory there. But tell us about it. Where are we on all this?
Well, the encampment at McGill is still going on, McGill has gone to courts. They're heavily involved with Israel, and I just want to know, can you hear me? It's okay?
Yes.
Yeah. They're heavily involved with Israel, and the encampment was set up in the end of April, and it's still going on. The McGill wants to get them off, but they're holding on. The University of Quebec à Montréal, UQAM it's called, had one. It lasted from early April till almost early May, and was over following a victory on the 6th of June, if I'm not mistaken. And they set it up. The UQAM went to the courts, but then it was sort of a split decision kind of thing where UQAM negotiated with the campers, and the campman was called the Université Populaire Al-Aqsa, the Al-Aqsa Popular University, to remind people of Al-Aqsa University in Gaza, which was destroyed.
Doesn't exist.
And
blown up.
They negotiated, and UQAM decided to have an academic boycott of Israel. The board of directors of the university called for an immediate ceasefire, and were decided to divest of any investments. They didn't have a lot, by the way, but any investments in Israel as well. In other words, they didn't have much. They already had a policy of not investing in military industries, you know. So that was a victory. Since about 3 days ago, many of the people from the UQAM encampment and McGill went down and are now camping at Victoria Square, which is at the doors of Old Montreal. Victoria Square, that's somewhat symbolic. There, it's in front of what is now the building of what they call the Caisse de dépôt et déplacement, which is Quebec has its own pension plan, and so it's the investment branch the investments. It's like the teachers' fund, you know, in investment, and that's where our pension funds come from. Mm-hmm. The demand is that the Caisse de dépôt, which is an investment body, divest of its 14.2 billion investment in Israeli companies. That is, it has an investment fund of 400 billion, which is the second biggest investment fund in Canada of public investment. You know, it's like the teachers or the Canada Pension Fund, and. So they're demanding that, and they're demanding also that Quebec overturn its decision to set up an office in Tel Aviv.
By the way, I thought the office is already set up. It's not?
They decided this year. They opened it in April, in the middle of what's going on now, of the current massacres and war. And So there's a lot of people who are calling on the Quebec government, including members of the National Assembly. The opposition parties are calling on Quebec to close that office. And so that is one of the two demands of the encampment, which started 3 days ago, 2 or 3 days ago, at Square Victoria, is the divestment and closing that office. So,
What kind of reception is that being heard in Quebec? I mean, what kind of commentary or treatment is the story getting there?
Well, it's getting coverage. It only happened, let's say, starting on Saturday, so there hasn't been much news, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, I haven't seen in the French language media, I haven't seen a lot of reporting against it. Here, it's, as you know, it's the Fête Nationale, Saint-Jean-Baptiste, which is Quebec's national holiday. It's a big holiday today. Everything's closed. And it starts really on a few days before. So I have to say the media is pretty skimpy these days.
Well, so, it sounds like a something that might on this day attract a little bit of attention. Saint-Jean-Baptiste, they can't be very enthusiastic about the name Victoria Square, can they?
No. Well, I mean, Victoria Square, there have been over the years, you know, a criticism of Victoria, you know, I mean, a very militant demands that it be changed. But that's off and on, you know, over the years. So you could say you could say that the campers, you know, the encampment chose a good place to go, to go to the, you know, the symbolic of Victoria Square. Mm-hmm. It also happens to be across the street from where the Caisse de Dépôt is, which is the investment fund, their offices. It's still early to say where it's going to go. They have about 50 people camping there. Uh-huh. And Saturday, when it was really set up, it was the day you have the demonstration, and the demonstration went there, you know, because we have weekly demonstrations from, you know, since the 7th of October in support of Palestine. So that's where they went. And we'll just see how it goes. The police are there. There was some people dressed in black, and there was a kind of a provocation there, but it didn't degenerate. That was yesterday. It took place.
When you say that,
the people who are doing it are a lot of the people who were involved in the UCAM demonstration encampment, and they were they did that extremely well. They handled that very well, like knowing how to go to a victory and then dismantle it without any. There was virtually no violence with the police. In other words, they won, and then they were able to dismantle it, and so they walk away with a victory, which is always great, you know.
Yes. Let's remind us again now. It's a national holiday in Quebec. It's been basically like 3 days, right?
Well, we have one day when everything is closed. It's not one of these holidays you can move around. That was under the Quebec government, under Lévesque government, that it was declared officially Quebec's national holiday.
Yeah, June 24th.
It's worth going back to where, worth going back to the founding of it. You know, the summer solstice was always celebrated in Quebec, but it was only in 1834 that it became political. And it was organized by the people who were in the Patriot Party. And this is their 1834, mm-hmm. and they held it on the 24th of June. And these were leaders, Georges Etienne Cartier, who ended up being a father of Confederation because he started working with the conservatives. He was there, there were a lot of leaders here, there, and they toasted some 60 different people throughout the world, including the Irish, McConnell, if I'm not mistaken, I can't remember where he was, but the Home Rule people in Ireland, and the solidarity with the Irish, and many others at the time, the American Republicans. So it was a founding of the St. John Baptiste Society. The people who founded it were exiled, some of them exiled during the repression of the rebellion in 1837 and 1838.
Yes.
But the society had a long and important history. And one thing that your listeners may be interested to know is that it was the Société Saint-Jean-Baptiste in 1880 had this huge convention from people. They had brought people in from all over North America, French communities, and that was when they asked Calixte Lavallée and Basil Routier to do a song, a patriotic song, so they wouldn't have to sing God Save the Queen.
Mm-hmm.
And that was O Canada. So O Canada was commissioned by the St. Jean-Baptiste Society. And, you know, the symbols were
Canada,
the maple leaf and the beaver. And so for 30 years, there was never even English words to that song. It was written in French, and people sang it heartily with the desire not to sing God Save the Queen or eventually God Save the King. I mean, I know some older people who said we just loved in school singing O Canada in the 50s and the 40s because we didn't have to sing God Save the Queen. Mm. And so, you know, this is an important thing for people to know where that these symbols, these words, were tonight when they're going to sing O Canada for the...
Yes, before the baseball game, before
the hockey game. They should remember that was composed in French as a patriotic song, not to sing God Save the Queen. And so the Société Saint-Jean-Baptiste has been involved, and it still is, involved in political questions. people have tried to, you know, make fun of it and laugh at the organization, but it is one of these organizations which has been a constant in Quebec's history.
It's very interesting. People, of course, in Quebec, you remember this. And on Victoria Day, Quebec was celebrating Patriots Day. Now, it's very interesting that we maintain Victoria Day. They're talking about changing it. They're always talking about changing it. Song, nation, whatever, dominion. But there were two Republican movements, and there was a rebellion in, they called Upper Canada.
Yeah.
And there is no Patriots Day here. People don't know that citizens of Upper Canada rose in rebellion against the Family Compact, et cetera, the upper class narrow group that was running the whole place, and were crushed and hanged. There is nobody, there is no demonstrations here of that, none. Meanwhile, in Quebec, it has become remembered as Patriots Day.
Yeah.
And, you know, an idea that I would like to our listeners and everybody to share, they wrote a constitution for the country they wanted to form, and they wanted to form a republic.
Right.
They didn't want to square allegiance to a foreign monarch. To this day, English Canada has a lot of trouble discussing this subject. But it's really at the core of the evolution of what they call loosely Canada, right?
Right, exactly. And, it is at that Declaration of Independence led by an English-speaking man here in Quebec, Robert Nelson, and he called for the liberation, independence of Quebec, And also, he called for equality for the indigenous peoples. This is in 1830. This was unheard of in the 1830s. And it was, it's a very striking document. And that document is read and often heard about on the radio during the day, during what you call in Canada, Victoria Day. And here it's
It is not read here at all.
No, people
that
don't
document,
know about this.
You have to hire a librarian and a lawyer to find the document.
Yeah. And
and they'll be arrested.
And the irony, I mean, it's an irony, it's a very sort of like sad irony, is that the monarch at the time that they hanged these people was Victoria. She came on to the throne
to be proud
in 1837. She was the head of state that hanged, a head of the state that hanged the people here in Quebec. And in Upper Canada.
The name comes to mind here is Samuel Lount, and they hanged him at roughly Yonge and King.
Right.
Corner of Yonge and King, roughly.
Yeah.
They hanged him roughly, and he wasn't alone. But frankly, let's say loudly, they're ashamed of him. There is shame here in the ruling circles. They'll never celebrate those people engaged in a rebellion for greater freedom, and for democratic institutions.
I think they would.
I guess the word for that is a disgrace. But go on. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think that they would have to deny so much of their own of the way they've told their story of Canada.
The people
who were the family compact, the ruler, British rulers. Here in Canada, well, these were colonies, and then the people who actually cobbled together Canada in 1867, they would have to deny them. They would have to be put aside if you were going to
reassessed. You know, there we've had this thing of falling statues or statues fit in boxes. By the way, John A. MacDonald, you'll be happy to know, remains in a box in front of Parliament. I think it's kind of an artifact and should be preserved, and there should be indigenous guard detail to make sure he stays there 24 hours. Anyhow, every day. This is a big failure. We may as well tell that extra chapter. After the rebellion, there was damage, a lot of damage done. People had property destroyed, and so the English side wanted to make sure they were all compensated. But then the people of Quebec demanded that they be compensated too, because they were farmers and civilians who had their homes destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was agreed that after many years that all these people should be compensated. And so when that decision was made, the English of English Canada burned down the Parliament and the library of the Parliament in Montreal, right?
Right. It was an Anglo-Tories here in Montreal. They went down and where the Parliament, this was the Parliament of United Canada, because after the repression, they had created a United Canada, which in itself, the Act of Union was a real kick in the face for the French-speaking population, who were a big majority in Canada, but then they lost a lot of their power. But in any case, they'd created the parliament here in what is now in Old Montreal, and the Anglo-Tories went down and set fire to the building, the library, and everything. And they even marched on Louis-Hippolyte Lafontaine, his home, because it was Lafontaine and Baldwin were the leaders of that government, and the army who was there did nothing, just let them do what they wanted to do, and
that's
they were called the people who roused them, the rabble rousers in that, was the Montreal Gazette. They were the ones that said, in the name of our race, we have to go down to demonstrate in the parliament. And they were carrying this flyer published by the Gazette when they were going down, and they lit fire to the building and burnt it down. I mean, now there's a memorial there that's been developed in the last 15 years. And so you can read it. It's still...
Who's in charge of memorializing? It must be kind of an argument, right? Who's going to...
Well, it was a big argument because the museum, which got the responsibility to do it, is highly funded by the federal government. And so one of the guys they called in to do it, to help them do it, was John Ralston Saul, who you might know.
Yes.
I'm sure we know.
He's been on CIUT, actually.
Has he? Yeah.
Yes.
But he's got a funny way of... He tried to compare... he's got a funny way of...
He's a compromising man working out a compromise for a bunch of compromisers.
That's what it is. And it's far from the truth of what happened.
Well, that's very important.
Very far from the truth. His description, he said it was very good. It was. He called LaFontaine Baldwin the Mahatma Gandhis of their time, because they chose nonviolence against these people who burnt the thing down. What he meant, of course, was that the British troops would never go after the British loyalists who had burnt the thing down. I mean, that was like you had British troops, and there was no way they were going to say, you know, what you've done is illegal, mm-hmm. and arrest them and where they should have been. So the people who burned it down lived on with total impunity.
Yeah.
And he thinks that was a good thing. John Ralston Saul. So, but at least right now, there is a reminder that that happened. And
yes,
they do say, because for many years it was vague, and a lot of the French-speaking people here in Quebec used to say, this must have been our fault because we were more wrong. And now at least it comes out who set the fire. And they do mention the Gazette. And I would say one thing about one of the reasons that it actually came to happen is because the St. John Baptiste Society decided this had to be made into an issue. That mm-hmm. the fact that the Parliament was burnt down and it was the Gazette and the Anglo-Tories who did it had to be made known, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, a detail there also is that the Governor General, who had to bring the decision that the British government thought that, yes, the French too should be compensated for losses, he almost got killed.
Right.
Because the loyalists, the I'm more British than the British people, wanted to kill the Governor General.
Right.
Because he said, yes, these civilians should be compensated. Actually, it's a little bit of an echo of we're hearing from Israel Gaza. Is it?
Right.
Should we feed the civilians? No, we may kill them.
That's true. Yeah. That governor, yeah, he was governor general. They were interested in the crown's future, and of course their future in North America. So they had to get along, and not have the French speaking people really mad at them. You know, what the people used. Who were then called the Canadians.
Yeah, there were people who were thinking in the ruling circles of the empire said, be careful, you start this and somebody else might finish it.
Right, exactly. And the local radical Anglos, the ultra-Anglo-Saxon violent people, they didn't think that way.
They lived on to call for the hanging of Riel.
Exactly. They were the orange.
They
people.
Always want to hang a French Canadian or a Catholic because
exactly.
they're not British. I have to mention, Robert, I was looking recently into the history of the Riel story, and mm-hmm. he was a founding member of the St. John Baptiste Society of Manitoba.
Right. Exactly.
And he was, I think that was 1870. That he, 1771, that he took that role. That was before he got into deeper trouble and was driven out of the country.
But he would have seen, definitely would have, like, he would have appreciated their view of the world at that time. And they were, they became more Catholic oriented after the repression, which had to do with the fact that if you were a Republican or if you were considered yourself a patriot, you were excommunicated. You were the church, you know. After 1837, they renamed streets in Montreal. They called Papineau Street, which was had Papineau's father's name. They changed it to Colborne, who was the military leader of the repression, and the in 1837 and 1838. They wanted to erase that history, which they haven't succeeded in doing. Mm-hmm. Although, as you say, they erased the history. They succeeded in erasing history in Toronto.
Yeah, you could hear crickets on the subject, but except in the form of a really profound negativism and desire to negate Quebec. I could say that one of the reasons the Taylor Report is talking to Robin Philpott, editor of publisher Baraka Books, about this topic is that the Globe and Mail today and over the weekend, they devoted pages and pages to what to do about Quebec.
Yeah.
And they say Quebec's place in Canada at great length. And I have to say to the Globe writers, why don't you just page back through your own paper? Because you've been writing and saying this actually since you came into being.
Right.
You have an itch that you can't quite scratch.
And
you will keep scratching. It starts off polite and it ends up with, this thing's got to be settled. We got to fix it. And oddly enough, repression doesn't lead to people loving you.
Is this
the way the ball bounces? Robin, what about today, the Saint John Baptiste? Do they issue some kind of statement? Are they programmatic? They talk about why the day matters and try to contemporize the point.
There a lot of stuff comes out. Where they have huge, shows, public shows had one in Quebec City last night, but it was just pouring with rain. But they had thousands of people there. And they have a patriotic statement by a leading cultural figure. It was an actor this time, and I haven't read what he had to say last night because I didn't see it. And then each one of these events that they have, and there are events all over the Quebec, where they have cultural shows, and they have a patriotic statement. That's part of what these events do. So they talk about what we want for Quebec and as a nation. You know, whether they're saying independence or not, but there is an effervescent, a rise, an interest once again in Quebec's future. After the 1995 referendum. People's national conscience of Quebec was down for various reasons. Follows defeat, some kind of sterile debates on different things, but the desire for freedom in Quebec is resurfacing. You can just tell it, and that may explain why the Globe did this.
Three or four pages today. They're actually attacking, perhaps you're familiar with this, there's something from Quebec, government of Quebec had a statement where they used the word national neutrality.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with this? And the Globe apparently wants to call out the... the Mounties or something, right? But so they're lecture. It's a lecture on you can't talk like that.
Yeah. Well, the current Quebec government's got in a bit of a bind. They're very low in the polls. The leader is a guy who was a former sovereigntist in from when he was a kid, until 2009, he quit the PQ and founded his organization. He wanted to basically straddle the debate.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's...
That's where the votes are.
Well, that's where they were. Right now, he's very low in the polls, and the guy who is the most popular leader is the head of the Parti Québécois.
And he's the one who said he wouldn't swear allegiance to the Queen to sit in Parliament.
He's the one who didn't swear allegiance. And he actually, because he said, no, I'm not going to do it, and he was elected, and he refused. As it turned out, that now people who are elected in Quebec don't have to swear allegiance. He won that point, and people saw his principled position, and he's taken...
Very important.
He's taken principled positions also on Palestine.
What does he say on that issue? What does he say?
Well, no, he said he was calling for a ceasefire on it. He was calling for a Palestinian state. You might say he was second off. The people who have led that in the National Assembly are the what you call Québec Solidaire. It's a left-wing organization. So they're for sovereignty as well. And there's a Palestinian member of the National Assembly, Ruba Ghazal, a Tunisian member of the National Assembly, and they have been, and the party as a whole has been very strong on Palestine in the National Assembly, and the PQ has gone along with it. And they haven't been leading it, but they've been made good statements about it. So, whereas the governing party and the Quebec Liberal Party, of course, are pro-Israel. Mm-hmm. And so the debate goes on, but...
As you said, the governing party now is in a minority in terms of public support.
Oh, yeah. And they're just going all over the place trying to find reasons. And so what I think that the article in the Globe was referring to, I didn't see that part, but they tried to set up a committee to find ways for Quebec to have more autonomy without becoming a sovereign country.
Yes.
You know, which is just basically, it's just, you know,
Canada's oldest existing
form.
You know? Yes.
So
it's quite a phenomenon.
Yeah, but that part might explain why the Globe has decided to spend all this ink on the question of Quebec, because they know that there's a rise of nationalism, sovereignty, and support for sovereignty. It's clear in all the polls. And so they know that somehow this question is not going to go away, whereas the current government under Trudeau has said, he talks about the post-national, you know, Canada's a post-national, you know, we're past the national state question.
Yes.
And it's like the post-race people in the States, you know, they
yes.
just never
They're like
occurred.
Ronald Reagan, he didn't see race, so he said we don't need any laws. Yeah.
And supposed race. So I think that phenomenon is, but I think the Globe understands that that's not exactly what's happening.
Yes. Well, lastly, tell us, there's a book I'm very interested in. One of our favorite guests, Tony Leah of Unifor, has written a really important book telling the true story of the organizing of auto workers at General Motors Oshawa and elsewhere in Canada. What's the title, and when can people get this book?
People can pre-order it right now on our website, but that's it'll come out in, it's officially out in November, November 1st. It's called with Tony, we worked out, it took a while, but we found a good title, we think. The Truth About the 37 GM Strike in Oshawa. Mm-hmm. And I'll find you the subtitle, because the subtitle tells us what's going on. Yeah, just let me get
it. Well, they
can
go to the site Baraka Books, right? And there'll be And the book and will be out in November.
It's a great read because you go through a strike and you feel like you're there, and that's a major task for a writer to put things together so that it reads like a novel, but it's very factual and very well, totally sourced, you know, material. But it tells a story of that strike, and also challenges a misinterpretation of that event.
Yes, well, the definitive book on the subject, and probably the only one, had been written by, was it Irving Abella?
Right.
And unfortunately, the book contained rather serious misrepresentations or errors, and I understand that Tony Leo was speaking in front of a group of more than 100 labor scholars only a week ago, and his thesis was very well received because he provided fresh information. It's been there all along. It's in his book, but it wasn't in the book by Abella, and it needs to be talked about because a lot of serious mistakes have been made in trying to assess labor history based on one or two books. We need actually a lot more books. That's why we're so glad to talk to a publisher. Robin, we're very grateful. It's full.
Could I just mention another book?
Mention anything you like.
Einstein on Israel and Zionism, the new enriched edition. We're putting out Fred Jerome's very important book, Einstein on Israel and Zionism. It's coming out in September. People can order it and pre-order it. It is a very, very important book. I think you've talked about it before.
We had, of course, the great pleasure. Fred Jerome was often a guest on the Taylor Report, and he wrote, he was one of the, I guess you could say, Einstein scholar. He was another one, like Tony Leo, who was pointing out there's a bunch of missing facts. For example, he highlighted the fact that Einstein joined with Paul Robeson to try to bring about an anti-lynching law in the United States. They were defeated, but the allies were Einstein and Paul Robeson. And no biographer anywhere in the English-speaking world mentioned that until Fred Jerome did. That's why you should get this book. People don't know Einstein's views on Israel.
What he reveals on Einstein on Israel and Zionism just flies in the face of what people, Zionists, have tried to make of Einstein,
We should remind people, Einstein, together with Hannah Arendt, told the American government not to allow Menachem Begin in the United States because he was a terrorist and a Nazi.
Right, exactly.
Think about that. And, of course, you can, if you like, you can call Einstein a fool, but it's, people looking at you will know which one of you is the fool.
Right, exactly.
No, it's the suppression or the hiding of the story of Einstein's views is, it's been broken by Baraka Books. They're bringing it out. When will that book be available?
September. Because we met with Fred's widow and they're thrilled, his family's thrilled to see the book come out because the original publisher sat on the book, did not do anything with it, and you can't get the book unless you're prepared to pay $250 on Amazon to get a copy of it. So we decided, and in this new edition, we've got his article about the killing of Count Bernadotte by the same Zionist.
Same group.
In 1948.
Yes.
You know.
A horrible story. Anyway. People should just look up Count Bernadotte and scratch your head. How come no one was ever prosecuted? A United Nations representative. Robin Philpott, it's a great pleasure talking to you.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Phil.
Wonderful
Thank
books.
You very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I remind you again that Jeff Halper is going to come to town. He's an Israeli anthropologist. He's going to moving towards a democratic state for all between the river and the sea. Jeff Halper, July 2nd at 170 Dundurn Street South in Hamilton. And July 4th, he's going to be in Toronto at the Friends House, 60 Lowther, and Science for Peace is sponsoring. It's an important thesis, and Halper has lived and struggled for equality of people in Israel, and I really hope people will attend.